had been assigned to the embassy down there. I don't know if it's Peru, Bolivia, or Chile, or what it was, but somehow he was out in the Andes with some other people, and an avalanche or landslide, I don't know which, came down and engulfed him and all who were with him. The loss of a very good man. He knew a lot of things that I wouldn't have expected him to know. After all, I'd been in the flying safety business for a year and knew, or thought I knew, those regulations backwards and forwards. And we had two categories of accidents, minor accidents and major accidents, and there was a clear delineation as to which was which. But I had classified some accident as a major accident, and he called me into his office one day, and he said, Captain, he said, I believe you're mistaken about this. I don't believe this is a major accident. I believe it's a minor accident. And we discussed it back and forth, and the more we talked, the more I could see that he was right and I was wrong. I was very impressed because I wouldn't have thought that he would be familiar with a piddling little matter like that, but he was, and furthermore, he was right. I always liked him. One time I decided to borrow the general's airplane for a weekend and fly down to someplace in Florida, Tampa, I think, but I'm not sure, and visit some of my old friends from the 49th Fighter Group, namely Bobby Harrison and Joe O'Connor, both of whom were stationed down there and flying P-51s. We had a P-47 of our own at Mitchell Field, and it was the General's airplane, or that's what it was always called, and it really was for his official use, but we were encouraged to fly it. So I signed up for it one weekend and flew down and landed somewhere in North Carolina to refuel. And the weather was not very good. It wasn't all that bad, but it wasn't very good down there, wherever it was. But the weather on beyond, after getting worse, then got perfectly clear. But the damned operations officer, wherever I landed, probably Wilmington, North Carolina, wouldn't let me take off. And I said, you know, with this airplane, all I have to do is just climb through all that stuff and fly over it, and where I'm going, Tampa, the weather is perfect. Well, truth was, I think he couldn't have flown through that weather, and he didn't think I could either, and he refused to let me go, and I sat there and cooled my heels for several hours, and I don't remember what happened. Probably the weather improved or something, but he finally let me go. And I turned out to be perfectly right. I flew down there, and the weather turned beautiful before very long, and I didn't have the least trouble. I stayed with Bobby Harrison and his wife down there, and I'm sorry to say I did something I regret. The day after I arrived, Bobby said, "Look," he said, "Harry, I'll check you out in P-51 if you will check me out in your P-47. And I was overly cautious. I don't think there was any need for that, but I said that I didn't really want to do that because it was the General's airplane. I said if it was anybody else's, I wouldn't care, but since it's the General's, I really am reluctant to do that. And he understood, and he agreed, and we dropped it. But there really was no sense in that, and I had a golden chance to fly a P-51, even though only once. And damn it, I let it slide through my fingers. And anyway, that's what happened. On the way back to Mitchell Field, well, as far as I can remember, that flight back was uneventful. I must have landed in Richmond or someplace for gas, but mainly I just flew on back and had no problems of any kind. First Fighter Command also had assigned to it a C-45, similar to the C-45 we had at Bradley Field. And since I had some time in it, of course I was authorized to fly it. And one day, I remember, one afternoon, Paul Slocum said, I want to fly out to Block Island, which was a little bitty island way off the east end of Long Island. I think there might have been a Coast Guard station or something there, but it was a little bitty island, and it had an airstrip on it, which was very short, and it ran from beach to beach. So you damn well better get down on it and stay down, because there was no overrun. So he said, you want to go with me? And I said, oh, sure, yeah. He was going to go down and get some lobsters. That was a good place to get lobsters. So he said, you fly down, and I'll fly back. And I said, okay. So he sat in the co-pilot's seat, and we flew down there. And as I said, it was a little bitty short strip. And we had with us the crew chief of this airplane. That was all, just the three of us. But the approaches to the strip were not what you might think. They were consisted of huge boulders. It wasn't sand or anything. It was damn boulders, and they were big. Not very high, but they were 2-3 feet high or something. They were nothing you'd want to tangle with, that's all I'm saying. So I decided to come in and drag it in low and slow, which is the way I found to make short landings. And it was the easiest way to do it, and that's what I did do. But again, at C-45, even though it didn't have any engines in the nose or anything, you couldn't see straight ahead very well once the tail went down on the ground. And so once I got it down, then I knew that this damn strip was very short, and I started using brakes like mad to make sure that I didn't run off the other end. It wasn't funny. And anyway, there was no problem, but when we had taxied in, shut off the engines, and the crew chief said, he said to me, he said, you didn't have anything to worry about. He said, after all, he said, if it come to that, he said, you could have used brakes and you'd have been all right. And Paul grinned, and he said, maybe you think he wasn't. Anyway, we stepped down there and got lobsters and took off and flew back to Mitchell Field. I remember Jack being very impressed. He said, imagine that, just taking an airplane like that and going wherever you want and just to pick up a bunch of lobsters. Well, we did. There was another occasion. I believe this was probably the last time I ever flew, but we had a base under our jurisdiction, as I mentioned earlier, at Fort Knox. And I flew out to Fort Knox, the P-47, one day on an inspection trip. And mostly in evidence at Fort Knox was the infantry. They had a big tank training base there, and there were fields and woods and stuff for miles around there, just riddled with tank tracks all around where they used for training ground for these tanks. But they had a nice big airfield, and the first day I was there, I decided to take a Jeep, which was equipped with what we called a mobile unit in it, meaning that it had a radio in it that you could communicate with the airplanes, the P-47s. And there was a youngster there, a black boy, a very handsome, good-looking young black guy, a private, I think, corporal maybe. And he and I drove out to the end of the runway and sat there in this Jeep so we could watch landings and takeoffs and see if we had any advice to give these people and so on. It's not we. He just went along to look after the I don't know what he went for, but I remember we sat there for a couple hours talking about the war, because by that time it looked like the war was about over. And when it came time to go back to Mitchell Field, the weather at that end was not very good, but it wasn't all that bad either. So I took off and flew back without a vent until I got around Delaware somewhere, and the wind rather abruptly into the clouds. Well, I was not too much concerned about all that, even though it started to rain. The airplane was flying well. I had plenty of gas. I knew exactly where I was, and I knew exactly where I was going. And this was not a case of being foolhardy. Exactly, I knew what I was doing, and I elected to do it. But the long and short of it was that the weather got worse and worse and worse the farther I flew. And after I'd got into this, and it was just pouring torrents, just coming down in buckets. But the airplane was flying well, and again, I knew where I was, and I wasn't having any trouble flying instruments. And I knew we had a homing station there, which we used to use all the time for practice purposes at Mitchell Field, and that he would, if I had trouble, he would get me in. So I got in, I got over in the vicinity of Mitchell Field, and I knew that from radio aids and devices. I knew about where I was. And I did what I planned to do all along. I called the homing station, and he gave me a vector and so on. And I couldn't see a damn thing. And so I went down lower, and occasionally I'd catch glimpses of the ground, but it was pouring rain, just coming down. And none of these vectors brought me within sight of the field, and most of the time I wasn't even in sight of the ground. And this homing station was getting sort of nervous, and I wasn't too comfortable about it either. And he kept giving me new vectors, and I would follow them, but I never came out anywhere near any place I recognized. And I remember one time coming out of the clouds, and I was right at the Bronx Whitestone Bridge, which was there plainly, and the towers sticking up into the sky and all that, and I knew then about where I was. Well, this went on for what seemed to me a half an hour or something. It couldn't possibly have been that long, but it was a long time. And I was skimming back and forth over the territory there and not getting anywhere. And, of course, the homing station was obviously disturbed by that time, and I don't think they were any more disturbed than I was, but we kept up this game of back and forth, round and round in the pouring rain, and suddenly I just burst out, and there was Mitchell Field right near me, and I called the station and told them I had the field in sight, and with their permission I was going to switch to the tower frequency and land. And I could practically hear the sigh of relief when they acknowledged my transmission. And I did. I called the tower, and they gave me instructions, and I landed. And it was still, even when I landed and taxied in, just pouring down rain. And I remember the tower operator at Mitchell was a woman. And as I was taxiing in, I knew that all these peace negotiations had been going on fast and furious with the Japanese. And I remember asking her, I said, well, is the war over yet? And she said, no, they're still arguing. And to the best of my recollection and the best of my records, that's the last time I flew for the Air Corps. I don't think I flew again. The peace was declared. I remember I went on into work. I should have just gone on home. But I didn't. I went into the office, and Arlene telling me, you know, she said, we have dropped some sort of bomb on Japan that's, well, I don't know anything about it, she said, but it's some stupendous big bomb, bigger than anything the world has ever seen before. And this was extraordinary news, but I didn't know from that what to make of it, and didn't remember making anything of it. I just adopted a sort of wait-and-see attitude. But, of course, everybody knows now what it was. I neglected to mention the fact that while I was at Mitchell Field, I didn't live on the base. They had nice, very nice bachelor officers' quarters, but I wanted a place of my own where I could play records and things, and I had my records with me. And these, of course, in those days were old 78s, and I had hundreds of them, and they weighed a ton, and they were a big chore to move. But I was lucky enough to find, to sublet an apartment in an apartment house in Garden City, which was a tiny little thing, just a real little room with a bed and a desk and a chair. That was about all. And had a little kitchenette and a little bathroom, and that was all. But I sublet this apartment and lived there quite comfortably and happily the entire time I was at Mitchell Field. And during all this time, furthermore, I spent a great deal of time with Paul and Peggy Slocum, Peggy's wife, and I used to have meals with them a lot of times, and we would go places together. We spent a great deal of time together, and they were very, very nice to me. And they would have parties from time to time. We'd go to parties. I remember one time, which has remained with me, Paul and I were alone, and we went out to dinner somewhere in a restaurant, public restaurant, and we were sitting there at this table having dinner, and two huge, big sergeants, like 6 feet six or something, I don't know, there were two of them, and they were eating there also, and they got up from their table and came over to us, and I thought, they are drunk, and they're going to start a fight. I just can see it coming. And I turned out to be completely wrong. One of them, who seemed to be served as a spokesman, said, excuse us, sir, but we would like to shake hands with you gentlemen. You guys have saved our lives on several occasions, and we'd like to say thank you. Of course, they didn't mean us personally. They meant the Air Corps. And Paul and I were both unready for this, and of course we did. We got up and shook hands and thanked them for their kind remarks. But I mention this because a lot of people used to go around and say that the Army, the infantry, didn't like the Air Corps. Well, that simply isn't so. I think for troops that never been in combat, it might have been true. They might have had some feeling of rivalry and envy and so on, but I don't think there was any truth of that in that whatsoever as far as people who had been in combat were concerned. When I was in the hospital in New Guinea, most of the tent that I was in was taken up by wounded infantrymen, and they were as nice to me as anybody could be. And furthermore, when we used to do all those innumerable patrols day after day over the troops at Buna and around, I don't think any of us ever lost sight of the fact that we were damn lucky to be able to go home and sleep in a dry bed at night. And if we ever had any occasion to do anything for the infantry, we would have leaned over backwards to do it. I remember old John Benner up at Goosep, and he was a sarcastic guy, and most of the people didn't like him very well. But I did. But anyway, when people would complain bitterly of what a dreadful existence they were leading and how terrible things were, he'd give them a cold stare and he'd say, yeah, how many mud puddles have you slept in lately? That always shut them up. I never heard any of them continue his list of complaints after that. So I think the stuff about the infantry and the Air Corps and the Army and the Air Force these days, disliking one another, is a lot of baloney. I don't believe that for a minute. I'm not denying there are individuals who do, but I don't think that's the rule. I forgot various things, no doubt. But one of them forgot to mention something that happened at Bradley Field while I was still there, which has remained always in my mind. And that was something that happened about March 1945. And by that time, it was obvious that we had pretty damn near won the war in Europe. And the Air Force had started sending home various bomber outfits to give them a chance to rest and recuperate and put themselves back together and getting them ready to transfer them to the Pacific, because of course at that time we expected the Pacific War to continue for a long time. And we were selected at Bradley Field in March 45 to receive a B-17 group on its way back from England, and they were supposed to fly into Bradley Field from England, and we were supposed to take care of them and get them all fixed up and send them on their way. We had a lot of unused barracks at Bradley Field, and these had been not boarded up, but they were unused and empty and unheated. And it happened that the weather at this time in Connecticut was bitter cold. It was not far from zero, and snow on the ground, and cold, and great deal of trouble was made with the preparations, and these barracks were heated. They had just coal stoves, a sort of coal stove. It was like a furnace, really, because it made hot air, which was dispersed more or less throughout these old wooden buildings. But, of course, they had no insulation on the inside. They were just clapboard things and single glazed and all that and big. So we had fires going for days beforehand to get them warmed up. And the telephone company came in there and put up just what I could only describe as batteries of phone booths so these returnees could phone home. And they were short on, we were supposed to outfit them on clothes. If they were short uniforms or shoes or socks or whatever, we were supposed to see that they got issued new ones before they left us. And I suppose, I don't know who came. Obviously, the pilots and the co-pilots all came, and the crew chiefs. And but how much of the outfit came along besides that, I don't know, but certainly those. And their arrival was very much like the arrival I've described twice before of the B-24s from Hawaii into Townsville, Australia. These B-17s came in one afternoon, a whole line of them, and they just came and we had them lined up every parking place we had, and then down one side of one runway and up the other side and down the other side of the next. We had them everywhere. God knows how many airplanes they brought in, but they all came. And so they were fed, and people were detailed to, officers were detailed to look after their wants and needs, and each an officer was assigned to each barracks, and I was assigned to one of them. And the bad part was that it was so cold, and these guys were not properly clothed for this kind of weather. Some of them didn't even have overcoats. Most of them did, but some didn't. I don't know whether they just didn't bring them with them or what. But the poor guys were never warm. We never got those buildings really warm in that kind of weather. Though they were decently comfortable, but we had time even keeping them. You know, they all came in there and they all wanted to take showers and shave and all this. And there was a problem just providing enough hot water. There were hundreds and hundreds of them, I guess, all told. And anyway, we looked after them the best we could. And they were only there 3 days probably. And one morning, a special train was laid on. Came in, I remember it, because it had a diesel locomotive, which was not all that usual in those days. And the whole train, passenger train with a couple of diesel locomotives on it, came right into the base, right smack into the Bradley Field. And these guys were all put aboard and taken off, God knows where, but somewhere. But it was a moving sight, really. They were all just back from England and glad to be home. And actually, we were glad to see them. Who came and took those airplanes, I don't know. But every day, people would come in there and fly away a couple of B-17s until eventually they were all gone. And but it was an episode worth mentioning. Well, once the war was over, I was given to... people were asked who wanted to stay in and who wanted to get out, and I said I wanted to get out, and I was given to understand that it would be several months before this could take place. But it wasn't several months, it was only a week or something, and orders suddenly came and said you were to report to Fort Dix, New Jersey, for discharge. And I wasn't even quite ready to get out quite that soon, but... I wasn't going to turn it down either, of course. So I went down and reported to Fort Dix, where there were tens of thousands of people, of course, at that time, all being discharged. And it was so soon after the war was over that they weren't all that well organized, and there was a good deal of confusion and snafu here and there, but somehow everybody did manage to get processed and discharged out. And I got out late in the day, I remember, and took a bus or a train somewhere and was met by Jack, who drove me back to his house, and I stayed there for the next few days. And thus endeth this long tale. There is nothing on the other side of this tape. I have listened to most of these tapes already, and I'm aware that there are numerous errors of fact in there, and errors of diction, and errors of using one word when I meant to use another word, and so forth, and I'm not going to apologize for that. I just did these pretty much off the top of my head, and they'll have to stand the way they are. Somebody said to me, well, I wouldn't have done it that way if I had been you. You have to transcribe these things and edit them and all. And I said, I have no intention of transcribing them at all. They're just here they are, and they're going to stay the way they are. And so let no one spend any time pointing out to me all the errors that you found in here. I know it, and there are a lot of errors that you don't know about, but I do. None of them, as far as I know, significant or worth going back and correcting. So here we are on the 31st of March, 1985. 40 years after the end of World War II, and thus endeth this long series of tapes.